Shiver me timbers, you're listening to the Ship Shape Podcast.
This week on the Ship Shape Pro Podcast, we have Deirdre Colgan, founder of the crew clothing and uniform company Nautilus Yachtwear. A former charter chief stew, she's here to talk to us about the state of the yachting industry, inclusivity and building a brand in 2022. I'm Georgia Tyndale, editor and journalist and in the yachting sphere, and my co-host is Merrill.
I'm Merrill. I live on a boat out in Boston, Massachusetts. And yeah, it's going to be an exciting episode. So Deirdre, how long have you been in the maritime industry?
10 years this year. So it was 2012 when I joined. I originally was in architecture, studied in Ireland, worked in Ireland. 2008, big crash, lost my job, got headhunted, went out to St. Martin and worked there for 2 years and made lots of yacht crew friends. One particularly, Nick, he actually also built my website. He's just been a really important person in my life since. And he just kept saying, I think you'd be great because, you know, you live as a community, you live together, you work together, you live at work. So it does take really specific personality to be able to be crew. And crew are the best people. They really are. And I was fascinated by it, but I was like, there's no way I can live in a wardrobe. And, you know, I was pretty high maintenance at the time. And so I spent 2 years in St. Martin. I then moved home. Things still weren't great. Got headhunted again out to Barbados. Was working out there. Loved it. But things kept popping up in the newspaper about the company I was working for. Transpired, it was a Ponzi scheme. And when I had moved out there, I said, you know what, if this doesn't work out for any reason, I will give yachting a go. And it all went up in flames. I'm lucky I resigned and I left. And I'm lucky I did, because after that, immigration got involved. And if you've ever been deported from anywhere, it's really difficult to get your B1, B2 or any visa. So I'm very lucky. I decided for ethical reasons to just say I can't take a paycheck for this. And then went to Fort Lauderdale, did my STCW, did a stew course and just got started. Took a few months day work and then got my first job.
And now you're recording this out of Florida right now, right?
Yes. So I'm now actually a permanent resident because I'm married to an American. So that wasn't my plan. Was I'll do 2 years and then I'll move back to Ireland and I'll resume architecture. But life happens. And I was in a dive bar, an Irish dive bar called the Village Well. People may know it. And I met Colin and we were like, you know, long distance. I'd be in the Bahamas and he'd be in New York, vice versa. And, you know, eventually we talked about getting married and, you know, getting a house. And I was on a charter boat at the time. I had the idea for the business while I was on that boat. The captain on that boat was fantastic. And the boat had gone under, undergone a major refit and it had a stern extension. So we needed new drawings done and we needed to order the uniform. We needed the t-shirts. And he was like, but we don't have the drawings for the back of the t-shirts. And I was like, sure, I'll do the drawings. I have CAD on my laptop. And I drew out, I mean, it wouldn't be to scale. You wouldn't be able to pull measurements off it, you know, but it looked like the boat.
Yeah.
And dealt with a uniform company. And they were like, look, this needs to be in vector format. So having been used to, I mean, CAD is a vector, used to all the graphics programs, I was like, no bother. Did that, send it off to them. And I already sewed as a hobby, understood fabrics. And I just thought, you know what, maybe I could do this.
You know, one of the unique things about the maritime space is that seemingly everyone that we've interviewed comes from some different background unrelated to maritime, and then they get into it. So you started out doing architecture, right?
Yes.
So talk a little bit about how your previous career really helped to kind of build what you are doing right now. Like what skills were learned? What was that like?
One thing was that you can end up working really long hours. You know, you've got a planning submission, you end up working till 2 a.m, they order you a pizza, they send you home in a taxi, and you come back the next morning. So I wasn't put off by the idea of having to work such long hours. Then I had worked in various yard periods, and I could spot a competent tradesman. Like, I can spot a good carpenter. You know, I can see who knows what they're doing. I know how to protect the interior because I knew I had worked in higher end, like hotels and that were being refit. And I knew just how spaces should work. So I think everyone brings different aspects. And because I had good graphic skills and that as well, even things like table settings or, you know, doing menus and all of that for events and like team nights and all of that, like all of those came into play. Like I could use Photoshop and Corel and everything. So, and it is funny, like I do have a good friend who always said that she always enjoyed seeing what everybody brought. You know, she had been a marine biologist and she was on a boat where a family were living on board, and they went around the world, and she ended up teaching the kids so much about marine life. And yeah, I think everyone has something to bring to a boat. You know, there's a boat for everybody.
Definitely. So for those people who aren't too familiar with being a super yacht crew and what that experience is like, could you just give us an idea of what the situation was like for crew uniform when you kind of entered the industry, in terms of what people can expect to get from crew uniform and how that might differ from other types of clothing?
Crew tend to always look the same. We all look like young golfers. And when I joined yachting, there was very much a look, you know, there was like the tall, blonde, slim girls. I, at the time, was a lot slimmer than I am now, but I am only 4'11". I have dark hair. I am fuller chested, and I just didn't feel like I fit. And you know, I did have a really good friend who kept saying there's a boat for everybody. And I just was like, well, is there a boat for me? And my friend Nick, who I mentioned, he was on a big, like, I don't know, 80, 90 meter. And we went on a night out at one point, and the 7 or 8 stewardesses were there. They were like octuplets. And I was like, how do you tell them apart? And then I spotted a brunette and I was like, oh, there's a brown haired one. And he was like, oh yeah, she's on deck. So I found it all very intimidating. At the time, I was a size 2, which is like a UK 8. And I remember joining a boat and they were like, well, this is the largest size we carry. So they had a 00, a 0 and a 2. So they were like, you know, be mindful. There's all the snacks in the crew mess. You have to be mindful because, you know, as if there's, you know, bigger uniform doesn't exist. And yeah. I remember losing out on a job and asking the crew agent, and she was like, look, there's things we can't post about what they're looking for. And, you know, in not so many words, she told me I didn't fit their, you know, aesthetic. My brother is an aircraft engineer, and I remember him telling me years and years and years ago, because his wife was an air hostess, a stewardess, that people were not given the job, and they were given the reason of being cosmetically unfit. And just what a horrible thing to take. But then, you know, not every boat is like that. And I worked on fantastic boats with people of different races, like different. And the best thing about yachting is when you're part of a crew, like the best captains I have worked for are mindful of, like, let's not have a majority of one country. Let's have a really diverse crew. And you learn so much about people. You learn about different cultures, different backgrounds. Even, you know, people have different educational backgrounds and, you know, different family dynamics. And, you know, you learn so much about people. So, you know, why does everybody have to look the same when what you're looking for is a broad range of people? So when I initially started, I was just going to do embroidery. That was it. I was going to do like towels and polos. And I had a few customers say, well, you're going to have to expand if you want to compete. You're going to have to do the bottoms and that. And I just thought, well, why not take the opportunity then? Because the last boat I worked on, the first mate was female. And she was very fit and athletic. And the shorts that were on board, I mean, she wasn't comfortable to work in. And actually, after the dock walk article, she sent me a message saying, I'm glad my big arse was helpful to your business. I was like, cheers. So it's more about how can people be comfortable while they're working. But also, I think the yachting companies have come a long way, the uniform companies, and I don't think it is coming from the uniform companies. And I do think the industry has changed a lot, but I just would like, if there was someone like me who has started and it's made them feel bad about themselves, bad about how they look, you know, that maybe I can just have a little positive message that, you know, hang in there, someone's going to appreciate you. And not this one specific person is a good looking person. Like, you know, you're not ugly just because you're not 6 foot tall with a 26 inch waist, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel in some aspects that yachting is lagging behind other industries in this respect. I mean, the fact we're having this conversation in 2022 is a little bit nuts. And the idea that you have to fit the clothes, I mean, to me, that feels like a very sort of 1990s skinny attitude. You know, I feel like a lot of other spheres have moved on. So why do you think yachting is a little bit slow to kind of modernize? Is it because it's kind of managed privately? You know, every yacht is its own kind of domain. They can do what they want. Do you think that factors into why it's perhaps a bit behind on these things, one might argue?
I think so. And I think, like, it's kind of, it's, you know, a bit clandestine. It's closed. It's, you know, it's its own world. And it's quite elitist. And I do think some people think that this is the image that people want. This is what owners want. This is what charter agents want. But maybe if you got to know those owners, maybe that's not how they feel. And I do remember as well interviewing for a job and being told this would be great for you because the owner, he wants somebody, you know, pleasant looking, well put together. But the missus doesn't want anybody too pretty that she has to feel jealous of. And I was like, okay. So, like, you know, and I was happy enough with that. I was like, okay, you know, and like, I'm a normal looking person. And, but then there's owners and captains who just want the best person for the job. And, you know, and somebody who'll get along with people and be kind. And, you know, the biggest thing that anyone is looking for is someone who's not going to cause drama.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always find it interesting because I don't know what the situation is in the US, but in the UK, when you apply for jobs, you do not put a picture.
Oh, it's illegal here. But in yachting, it's required.
And whereas in Europe, they do include pictures, and I found that very odd.
Yeah, I never had to before yachting. And then most of the, like, crew recruitment companies, they'll ask for your measurements and your weight, your height and your weight. So it's, and they're like, oh, it's for uniform. And like, I've had interviews and they're like, oh, can you please send me your measurements for uniform? And then after that, so there's ways that they can do it, you know, trying to make it not seem like, well, we want your measurements so we can decide who gets the job. But, you know, maybe offer the person the job and then ask for the measurements. And I have had that before. Or, you know, like some boats just have so much uniform because they've had crew of every size. So you just get on board and you try it on and you see what fits.
So how does this factor into the models you would use for your clothing? Is that something you think about as well in terms of, as we've said, diversity and inclusion and being a bit more representative?
Yeah, I just want to use normal people, like maybe, you know, maybe use actual crew or people day working, just normal people. Because if you use one specific body type in your photos and your brochures and your website, you're not seeing what it looks like on everybody. And like, I want to look and say, okay, that might look like that on me. And I sew, so I follow a lot of people who sew on Instagram, and I'll be like, okay, they have the same body type as me and that looks really nice on them, maybe I'll make that, or maybe I'll buy a dress that looks like that. Because if I look at someone who's 14 inches taller than me, I can't tell what that's going to look like. And even like petite clothes are designed for someone who's 5'4". I'm only 4'11". That's another and a half. You know, that's another 5 inches. So I just think that I would like to have every body type and put, you know, this is Georgia. She's 5'3". She's a size 8. And this is what she's wearing in this size. And someone can go, okay, well, I'm 5'4" and I'm an 8, you know. So I, yeah, just have it be an easier experience. And then I also want to do that. You can get in touch and say, I'm not sure which size I am. I will ship the sizes. You can try it on. I'll send a return label. You can send them back and then say, this is the size I liked, and then order those.
Yeah, because I think it's really interesting, isn't it, as well, because of the emotional associations we have even with sizing. I mean, I don't know how this chimes with your own experience, but the emotional experience of going to a shop and trying something on is very much determined by that, you know, X, L, S, M. You know, those things are weighted. They shouldn't
be.
I think men's sizing may be different. And in Europe, I know they do like 32, 36, blah, blah, blah. But in the UK, we very much do small, medium, large, etc. And if you go from a small to a large, that feels like a kind of moral thing somehow, doesn't it? It feels like there's a lot attached to that. Whereas I know some clothing brands are now just doing it where they name the sizes after the women, kind of as you've been describing. So they might call it like the Georgia size or the so-and-so size. And you just fit the one that is closest to how you are physically rather than having it attached with those labels.
I think there is a huge pressure, and that's one of the things about sewing. It's whatever size I say it is, you know. And I mean, we've all had that breakdown in the fitting room where, you know, and also those mirrors that come from every angle and you're like, that's what my chin looks like from the side. And what is this lighting? And these jeans won't go past my knees, yeah. You know, and then I would have a bigger bum and thighs and a small waist. So, you know, sometimes if I get it over the bum and thighs, you know, it's 4 or 5 inches too big on the waist, and the same with skorts. So if they fit on my bum and thighs, they'd be huge on the waist, and then my radio would drag down and I'd have, you know, builder's crack, plumber bum, whatever you call it. And
plumber bum, not heard that one before. That's great.
I think it's an Australian one. And then if I had it fit on the waist, it would be riding up over the thighs. So it was, I would often just have to get the bigger size and then just, you know, tack it at the waist. So yeah, I found having skorts on sometimes uncomfortable, and they can be very short, and you know, you're having to climb up on top of things and get stuff, and so yeah, you don't want your bum hanging out. So, and I mean, it just happens. So yeah, I just wanted something a little bit more practical, because I think yachting has evolved a bit and not everybody is flat bottomed and flat chested now, so why not have clothes that accommodate that? And I do see some of the bigger uniform companies are using performance fabrics now, like I plan to do, with a bit more stretch and a bit more accommodating, and I think that's great. And I think, you know, some of these uniform companies are leading the way into making yachting more inclusive and more accessible. And you know, yeah. I think Below Deck as well kind of blew the lid off, because I started, I think, a year or two before Below Deck happened. And I mean, if I hadn't been in St. Martin, I never would have known that yachting was a thing. And I still meet people and they're like, what? How do you get to work every day? And it's like, no, you live on the boat, you know? So, and I've even had guests on the boat going, how do you get here every morning? And we were like, helicopter. You know, they didn't know that we were living in the bow. So, you know, now I think there's a broader range of people who come into yachting, and I think that's only a good thing.
So these people that were basically doing these interviews, were they primarily men, or were they women that were like, you know, body, it's almost like body shaming? And another question I have is, how have you seen a shift in kind of women leadership on these yachts over time? Like, is that changing around, or is it still primarily a male dominated?
I think girls on jet deck is changing a lot. For the first question, it was mostly really kind women who were put in this uncomfortable position and had no choice, really. This was their job, and would ask you then, look, I'm sorry, and, you know, are you okay? So they're not the people who are in the position of power. You know, they're not making that decision. They don't want to be casting aspersions on any young girl's body. But unfortunately, that's the position they're sometimes put in. But as regards girls on deck, so when I started 10 years ago, a friend of mine started at the same time. She wanted to be on deck, and she kept getting told, look, it's just going to be so much harder for you, go and be a stewardess. And she did a lot of deck day work, and eventually, you know, to make a living, she became a stewardess, became really good at it. But I've worked with 2 great female first mates, and I mean, they had to work harder to prove themselves. And you see more female captains now. Like, my husband talks about, like, 20 years ago, he had a female captain. And at the time, there just weren't female captains. And the judgment that she came under then for any decision or any mistake, you know, that any captain may make, I think was a lot harder. But like, if you look at, you know, DockWalk now do like a help article, and it's a female captain, Kelly Gordon. And then I was doing work for a boat, and the captain was female, Sally Ann, and she was just a phenomenal person. And she was involved with an organization called She of the Sea, who are trying to promote like women on deck, female captains. And like a really, really good friend of mine, Jason Bacon, he's from Grimsby. He is a captain of a big charter boat, and he's my biggest customer. He, I think, is someone who, I mean, he has a gay couple on board. He has a female first mate. Like, he does not care what you look like, who you are. If you are the best person for the job, he wants you on his crew. And there are more and more people like that. And, you know, I think it is a male-led industry. And unfortunately, it takes men like that giving women the opportunity and giving them drive time and letting them step up to mate to change. It's unfortunate that it's not women who can really, but like She of the Sea can create more exposure. And like the last boat I was on, Captain John, like we had a female first mate and she was extremely competent. You know, they had a good relationship and he could trust her. And like that, when she interviewed, she was the best person for the job. And I do think there are more and more captains out there who are, you know, she wasn't sure about doing courses and that. And he was like, no, you can do this. You're going to do those courses. And I think that's what any captain does for any mate when they doubt themselves. And she wasn't treated differently than the male deck crew. You know, she was treated the same. She was pushed just as hard. And he was like, you know what? You should do this and you can do this. And she did. So
on the structure of boat, who really has the final say? Is it like the captain who's in charge of making these decisions, or is it the owner of the boat that is making these decisions? Like, you know, what is the decision chain?
Well, the captain has a license. So, I mean, I was chief stew. I had a certificate in flower arranging. You know, I am not going to, like, nobody's going to die if I lose my flower arranging certificate. It doesn't matter. Oh. A captain can make a wrong decision. He can take an order he shouldn't take and he can lose his license. He doesn't just lose his job. He loses his career. He loses his reputation. He loses his livelihood. And you have to put your faith in your captain because, you know, I see the interior. I see cocktails. I see beds and heads. I see my stews. He sees everybody. He sees every aspect. And, you know, I mean, my husband has been in the position where he's been asked to do things that weren't safe and he's had to say no to the owner. Like, you know, I mean, he was on a boat a few years ago where the fire suppression and fire alarm system wasn't working. And he was like, you know, we can't do your trip. We are not taking the boat out. Like, we are not putting lives at risk. And that's a really hard position to be in, to say no to the person who pays your wages and put your job at risk. But it's not easy to be a captain. And sometimes as crew, you get really annoyed because you're like, oh yeah, you know, they make all the decisions. I'm just here, you know, I'm just the pawn. And you feel like you've no control over your own life. But, you know, you need to have that faith. And I worked on a boat with mostly Italian crew and the captain used to say, this is not a democracy. And that's how it was. And that we had to call him master. Because I think it's a translation thing because he was an Italian and a captain is the master of the vessel. So, I mean, it does sound a little bit, you know, sub-dom, but it wasn't that kind of relationship. I think it was just a translation thing. But that was something I always remember then. It's not a democracy because what do I really have to lose? A job. They could lose everything. They could end up in court. They could be prosecuted.
Yeah. So what would you normally call your captain?
Usually, I mean, most captains by their first name. So, and actually my first captain on my first boat is, I mean, him and his wife are my child's surrogate grandparents now. I mean, we go up there for weekends. They just drop down like some furniture for him. I was just printing off pictures on canvas. Like we talk to them all the time. They're the emergency contact for school for my child. And they're just great people and, you know, great friends. And so, yeah, I think most captains I've just called by their first name. Like I did work on one really big boat and 78 meter and 23 crew. It just wasn't the right fit for me. I never worked on that size boat again. I didn't enjoy it. You have no access to the captain at that point. You know, you have your head of department and then even the first mate is kind of off limits. So you have the second mate who kind of deals with crew in that position. So it does depend on the on the boat and the size of boat, what that relationship is.
And so obviously you came into yachting with, as we all do, with preconceptions and ideas about what it's like. What have been some of the major things that have changed since you've actually been working there versus perhaps what you thought about it beforehand?
God, that's a hard one. I think I didn't realize just the sense of community that there is. And one of the reasons of wanting to start a business targeting yachting was, like, when I left yachting, I had gotten pregnant on my husband's 40th birthday. And I, you know, had to give up my job. And I mean, that was on the cards, but I had wanted to do another year. And I loved the boat. I loved the crew. I loved the owner. I was supposed to be working towards getting rotation. Like, later that year, I was going to be doing three on, three off. And I was like, that way I can build the, sorry, something just fell down, the build the business slowly. And then that's not what happened. So I rented a small apartment. My husband was away. He was up in New York. And I was in the Bahamas when I found out. And he was in Florida. By the time I came back, he was up in New York. So I went from being with nine crew, you know, there was, if you wanted to just hang out and watch a movie, there was someone to watch a movie with. If you wanted to go to the beach, there was someone to go to the beach with. Like, we would all go see a film together, like, you know, and just went then to just being on my own, you know. And I was still chatting to them and that. And like that, it was the summer, so all the boats were gone. And like, what I had thought before yachting was like, God, it's going to be really hard to live on board and live in such a small space and live with all of these people.
Yeah.
But living with those people in such a small space ended up being the best part of it.
Yeah.
You know, just the laugh you have and, like, you know, filling someone's cabin with balloons so they can't even open the door on their birthday. And just, you know, you're in laundry and you find the women's underwear in the deckhand's pocket and, you know, just, you know, you stick it on the notice board. All of those silly, silly things. I had no idea the impact that crew would have on my life and how much, like, I always shied away from confrontation or standing up for myself or, you know, speaking up and being heard. And you learn pretty quickly as crew, if you don't address something, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just ruins the experience for everybody in that crew mess. So I really learned how to kind of conduct myself in a more professional and just a better manner. And the things that I thought would be scary, and also, like, I'm not a very outdoorsy person, like, I, you know, so I was kind of pushed to do things that I never would have done, and they were terrifying, but they were great.
So, like what?
Like jet skiing. And yeah, and actually the first jet ski I ever went on, so the owner had been like an ex like motorbike driver, so we had these like custom super fast jet skis. So they were not just a normal jet ski. So on the back of that thing, like, oh my God. So, but you know, I did it and it was great. Like sea bobs, you know, going under the water with a sea bob, swimming with sharks.
Wow. Have you had any really memorable travel experiences, like places in the world that you've been that were just incredible?
Yes. So I was really, really lucky. The second boat I worked on, we did the Northwest Passage. So we were only the seventh yacht ever to complete it. And it was completely life-changing. I actually have a map on the wall upstairs framed, and one of the guests made it, and it plots our course and the date they were there. I mean, it was such an incredible experience, and to do it with such an incredible crew. And, you know, I still look at the photos and I'm still just baffled. You know, we got trapped in the ice. We had to have a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker come and like get us out of the ice and then follow them out. And we had Captain Toomey. He was apparently the premier ice expert in the world. So he's British. He was in his 80s. He'd been at sea since he was 15. He joined he'd moved to Canada. I think initially he was British Merchant Navy and then moved to Canada. So he'd been at sea for 65 years. And the stories that he had, you know, and he was actually writing a book because every day he's been at sea, he's kept a journal. And, you know, but I mean, we saw a polar bear, and we're like, oh my God, polar bear, look at this, you know, looking out the window and seeing a polar bear. And we had an Inuit guide on board who had all of these guns and that in case polar bears got too near. And just, like unbelievable, yeah. Like whales coming up next to the boat, like just indescribable. And then, you know, we went to Greenland and Canada and then down the east coast of the States after that. So it was, I mean, I feel like I got the best out of yachting. So that was it. So when I did have to leave yachting, I was like, well, you know, I'd done the Med, I'd done a lot of the Caribbean, I'd done the Northwest Passage, and I would have liked to do the Panama Canal. But I was like, you know what, I've gotten the best out of it. And I've had these really memorable experiences. So I was okay with it.
So, you know, we just heard a pretty incredible story of some travels. Now, I got to ask you, what is the one of the worst stories that you've heard of or been a part of? You don't need to put names or anything, but like one story where you're like, thank God I'm not on that boat.
Oh, God, I did a freelance trip. Once the chef cut the tip of her finger off, the mate's father died, and we hit a pylon in Atlantis. So that was pretty bad. But then I did work on one big, big sailboat that is quite infamous. And I knew before I took the job, it was my first chief stew job. And I initially turned the job down a couple of times. And then I was like, whatever, it'll get me my three strikes. So the owners are in their 90s. They're an old Jewish couple from New York. She's dreadful. She hates any food. Like, she just would complain about food. All she wants to eat is burgers, but she wants... So a chef would never last more than 1 or 2 days. They would get... She would fire them. But we had a chef on board, and he made appetizers, and I brought the appetizers out. And she was like, what's this? And I was like, it's your... whatever it was supposed to be. And she was like, it's supposed to be a triangle. It's not a triangle. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry, Mrs. You shall remain nameless. And I had to bring it back. And she's like, well, it's not a triangle. So, yeah. So everything we brought out. And then another time I brought out ice cream. She wanted ice cream. And she kept shouting at her husband, giving out to her husband. And it melted. And then she gave out to me because I bought ice cream that melts too quickly. So she wanted different ice cream. So I brought out, it was like a chocolate chip, but the chocolate chips were too waxy. And she was just nuts. And she, when she asked me my name, because she was quite hard of hearing, I was like, Deirdre. And she was like, Teardrop, Teardrop. So she thought my name was Teardrop. And she was like, did your mother not want to have you? And I was like, Deirdre. And like, she used to leave tissues and toothpicks like in couch cushions and stuff for you to find. Like, just, she was awful, but she was kind of hilarious too. And like one time, because she used to come with racks and racks and racks of clothes. She didn't leave clothes on the boat because she was worried we would steal them. So, and where we were docked in Port Washington, there's, you know, the adjustable bridge for the floating dock. So at low tide, it's really steep. But she had so many clothes in the front of the golf cart that she had to sit on the back when she was leaving. And she was just screaming, oh my God, this is not how I want to go. This is not how I want to go. She thought she was going to fall off the back. So one of the deckhands had to like run up behind the golf cart with his hands up so she would feel more secure, like she wasn't going to fall off the golf cart. And then another thing was, I made her bed too tightly, and she accused me of trying to do away with her because she thought she was going to suffocate because she couldn't even move her arms. And so that was, I mean, like, it was hilarious. I mean, she was dreadful, but I mean, it was really funny. But there was three kind of bad things that happened on that boat. One, when we were docked in Port Washington, there was a restaurant. You could take a water taxi to the restaurant, and we were up on deck one day, and there was this huge bang, like huge explosion. We all hit the deck. But it was a house behind the restaurant. There was a gas explosion. The next day, the mate and the engineer were on the aft deck. A body floated past the aft deck. So they had to get the police and the Coast Guard out, but I did not want to see. And then a week later, the engineer was on the tender with the owner's grandchildren on the Hudson River. And what floats by? A body. And they have to wait for the Coast Guard and the police again. And then we were coming back from Newport to Port Washington, and there's a Mayday call, and we were the closest vessel. And it was this tiny little fishing boat that had run aground. But then we had one engine that wasn't working. So by the time we got close enough to them, the police were already there. So
well, at least it wasn't, by the time you got over there, there was a bunch of bodies like floating in the water.
So I did the season on that boat, and I was like, you know what? Like, and then years later, I got a call. There was a new captain on board and they couldn't find a stewardess because it had such a bad reputation. And I was the only one who hadn't left on bad terms with the missus. And I actually went back for 6 weeks in a freelance role. And my nephews, they used to love the stories of her. So they were so excited when I went back. And they came over to visit a few years ago. And we were on the water taxi. And the boat was at Pier 66. And she was sitting out on deck. And they were so excited. And when they went home, my brother was like, what was the best part of your trip to America? And they were like, we saw her sitting on the boat. Like this legendary, batshit old lady who just... I mean, she was just nuts, but she had six children and they were all wonderful. So she must have been a good person at one point in her life to have created such lovely humans. But she's not quite as lovely now.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for that. It's always fun hearing these stories, definitely. So just touching quickly on being an entrepreneur, obviously you're launching your business. How is yachting as a sphere to kind of launch your business? Because obviously it's got its niches and its quirks. How have you found it? And is there much support available from the community for people launching businesses?
I think there is. And like when I was in yachting, I would always try and support the smaller businesses and newer businesses. And people I know have been, like most of my orders now are people that I do know. So obviously I'm trying to expand past that. And I think having been crew, you're part of their world. So I think there's more of a sense of trust. And I think there's huge support. And even, you know, the reaction when I did the Dockwater article, people I hadn't heard from in such a really long time, just getting in touch and saying, hey, good for you. I didn't know. And, you know, I've actually had two other yachtwear companies be helpful. Like a few years ago when I first had the idea, I was in a yachtwear shop with a friend of mine. And I said to the owner, I'd love to do something like this. And he brought me back. He showed me his direct-to-garment printer. He showed me the embroidery machines. He had been a captain. And then there's another small uniform company like me. It's just one person. It's female-owned. And through a friend, was put in touch with her. And we've met up a couple of times. And, you know, she was looking for somebody who did, you know, rash vests that were recycled, and I put her in touch with a company I use, and she's given me advice. And so there's not that sense of competition or that, I don't think, really in yachting. I mean, maybe there is and I just haven't encountered it, but yeah, everyone's been really helpful. And what I've done is, you know what, give me a chance, give me a small order, and if you're happy, then, you know, then give me more. And I have some boats switching over to me now, switching more and more stuff over. And I think like that, people are like, you know what does it hurt? We'll give you a chance to do the few bits. And then it's grown from there. But yeah, I think as people though, crew are really supportive and very community minded.
That's great. And what if you're a young person, let's say for the sake of argument that you're a woman and you want to enter the industry, you want to be crew, what would you say to a young woman who's thinking about doing that, but maybe doesn't feel like they fit, you know, the mold of what they think crew should look like? And actually this question is applicable to anyone. What would you say to someone who is, you know, oh, I want to be crew, but I'm worried that I won't be accepted because I'm XYZ, fill in adjective here.
There is a boat for everybody. If I can do it, anyone can do it, you know. And my first ever chief stew, she was like, oh, you know, I just don't think you'll ever make it as a charter stew. And I ended up as chief stew on a, you know, a big charter boat. So don't listen to people who only see one facet of you. And if somebody doesn't value you for who you are, what you look like, where you come from, then that's to do with them and what's in their head, and more to do with how they feel about themselves than a reflection on you. And especially smaller boats, I just don't think there is that prejudice. And for me, I felt like all I could see was the prejudice because I focused on it so much because I felt so bad about myself. And once I got on my first boat, you know, and got over that, you know, like it was more about being a good crew member, more about being on time, more about getting your job done. And, you know, I mean, the biggest thing that I felt was if you make a mistake or something happens, own up, say it. Yeah. And provide a solution, say this happened, but I have this solution. And yeah, that ended up being for me the most important thing was, and nobody really cared. And you end up gravitating towards boats and finding boats that are more fun and inclusive and aren't, you know, you kind of end up, you know, that kind of felt like the other yachting to me. Like I wasn't a part of that and they weren't a part of me. And, you know, they have their world. And so it did take me a little bit longer to get a job. Like I was 29 when I started yachting. I wasn't tall and I wasn't from a country that is known for its crew. You know, there's not like a load of Irish people running around Fort Lauderdale looking to get on boats. So I, you know, and then I had a friend who was 22 and South African and skinny and blonde and had done some modeling and she got a job straight away, of course. Mm-hmm. But once I got that first job, it was great. It was, you know, once I had that bit of experience. But the other thing is like, when I joined, I was like, I want to go in a big boat. I want to go in this. It's not about the size of the boat. It's not about where the boat's going. It's about the owner and the captain and the crew. They're the most important things. Because you can go to the most wonderful, most beautiful place in the world and be miserable because you don't have that support. So it's just for me, you know, pick a good crew, be yourself, because if you kind of portray this image as a certain person and then you get on board and you live there and you work there and you share a cabin with someone, you're not going to be able to keep it up. Everybody's going to see who you are, and I'm sure who you are is wonderful. So there's no need to hide it.
Yeah, I think what you said about, you know, once you were there and you could actually do the job, all the other stuff didn't really matter, I think is great. It's just that question of gatekeeping, isn't it? It's that question of, as you said, with the fantastic captain you were describing earlier, who, you know, gives people the opportunities and trusts people. It's getting through the door, isn't it?
That's it. And when I joined that boat, they had had two chief stews previous to me who'd only lasted about a week. And it just wasn't the right fit. It wasn't a reflection on them. It wasn't a reflection on the boat. You know, the captain had nothing negative to say about them. They just weren't the right fit. And one thing he did explain to me was that the owner, we were switching to charter, so he needed somebody who could do the silver service, do the high-end service. The owner is a very relaxed family man. He didn't want all the pomp. You know, it made him uncomfortable. He just, you know, some boats, there's a wall between you and the owner. You don't really get to chat to them. He wanted somebody that could have a laugh, have a chat. So there was kind of two different roles that you were fulfilling. And I joined that boat actually freelance. I was just going to get them through the yard period because they were having a big refit done. And then when John asked me to stay, he was like, I think you're the right person for me. You're the right person for the owner. You're the right person for the crew. And that took 6 years for me to believe, God, that's true. Like I am. And it was the right decision. And as much as I hadn't wanted to leave Florida and leave, you know, my husband. And then I later found out that the captain and Colin had been friends like 20 years before. So we didn't know, but they knew each other. So, you know, and I really was. And it was a huge moment to feel like, God, yeah, I am the right fit. Like, not that there was never issues and not that myself and John didn't butt heads or not that, you know, I never had crew issues. But like, if you do get a job and it doesn't work out, maybe you just weren't the right fit for that boat, or that boat was not the right fit for you.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about imposter syndrome just rings true and is a common theme for many of our guests, even the most famous boat designers. Everyone gets a little bit of like, oh, am I really the right kind of person for doing this? Oh, I'm just making it up as I go along, blah, blah, blah. And I think yachting can feel like that, especially if you think it's a certain thing, you go into it and then you realize actually, no, maybe there is a place for me. And I think that is one of the nice things about the industry is you can find your place. It might just not happen immediately.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, sense of humor, I think, is the biggest thing. And like the boat I did the Northwest Passage on, so there wasn't internet or TV, so we could watch DVDs or that, or, you know, sometimes when we would get in somewhere, we'd be all there with our laptops trying to like, I'll download this episode of Breaking Bad, you download the next one, you know, and things like that. But we would end up like playing Pictionary and charades and things like that. We were like off the grid and it was hilarious. It was just, you know, just really silly and fun and hilarious. We all had cameras and, you know, I learned a lot about cameras and photography from like the bosun on that boat. And, you know, you never know what you'll pick up. Like I had the stew on that boat trying to teach me to knit. Never learned to knit, but I do crochet now. It's a great boat hoppy because you get to the end of the crossing and you have a scarf or something.
Aww.
So, you know, you just never know what you're going to learn from crew or what crew might learn from you, what you might bring. So
as we wrap this up, tell us where people can find you. How would people go about placing orders with you? How would that work?
So it's nautilusyachtwear.com. And then I'm on Facebook and Instagram as well at Nautilus Yachtwear. So it's all done on a quote by quote system. So you don't order directly off the website, because basically when I order the blanks from a supplier, the bigger the order, like the more bigger the amount, the less money I pay. So I try and pass that saving on. And then, you know, embroidery is done price per 1,000 stitches. So it's quote by quote basis. So yeah, or send an email to info@nautilusyachtwear.com and I can send a quote. As I said, you know, I've had people get in touch who maybe don't have the right file type or anything. I can do all of that. I have all the softwares. So anything like that, just send your image, send whatever, we'll work it out. You know, if you have an idea, maybe what you want your crew to look like or something you've seen, I'll find it for you. And then the phone number is the US number 954-408-1747.
Well, I know that we need to get some hats for this podcast.
Really?
As a giveaway. So yeah. We're going to have to figure that out.
Yeah. I actually just did 140 puff hats. So
what's a puff hat?
Oh, it's the 3D embroidery. I have one here. This is actually...
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah. So it gives it a 3D effect. So I just did a bunch of those.
We'll take 140 with the ship shape branding, please.
Yeah. Get in touch. I'll send you a quote. I'll give you a good price.
Thank you.
Actually, I really do. Also, I really like my business phone number because the last three digits are 747, and that was my dad's nickname. He was a Boeing engineer for years. So that felt like a nice little nod.
Well, it was amazing talking to you, and
you
I look
too.
Forward to
so
seeing you guys in the future and seeing you guys at all the boat shows and seeing your apparel everywhere.
I hope so. I really hope I can make this something.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode and be sure to like, share and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.